WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
I was drinking some kind of powdered orange juice. she's a housewife. And her husband's with the night shift at the plant for 30 years. They got a nice little trailer in a nice little court. And a poodle they love like a child they never had. They go to the VFW club on Friday night. She gets a sludge in fest and some fries from the kitchen. Tips the waitress 50 cents. Has her hair done the same way that she has for 30 years. Some say life's useless. Born it's dull, but she's happy, she's satisfied, and nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Ailis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't have, 'cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy. She has a hobby. She paints ceramics and bowls twice a month. She goes dancing with her husband when I can, or to the wrestling matches at the local arena. Some say life's useless, it's fun and still, but she's happy, she's satisfied. Nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Elvis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't have, 'cause she's happy. But she's happy, she's satisfied, and nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Elvis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't have, 'cause she's happy, she's happy, she's happy. And nearly every day she cries when she remembers the day that Elvis died. She doesn't covet what she doesn't.
Sleeping. with Blue Rodeo here, 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
On this useless night, with you so far away, I stand in front of this Ferris wheel, and I wonder, what am I doing here? And I wonder, what am I doing here? And all the drunks just stumble by and tell me, what is the use?
keep your hands to yourself. Keep your hands to yourself.
Yeah. We all make choices about alcohol. Kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad. Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em. Remind me about that party again.
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations, and they want honest answers in everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
WRCT Pittsburgh, your oil revival station.
I need answers to my tax questions. Where can I find them?
Need answers? Try our interactive tax assistant on irs.gov/ITA. Simply select your tax questions, provide your information, and it gives you answers. Also, check our help and resources page and try our online tax map. 5,000 tax topics from A to Z. Plus, you can access forms, publications, in a variety of formats.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, just because we might witness the daylight robbery of the social benefits we've been paying for and counting on for the entirety of our working lives, and just because Black people are no longer allowed to even mentor Black people coming into fields they've been historically excluded from, and just because any program receiving public funding will now have to officially pretend that there are two genders, doesn't mean the environment isn't still in immediate peril. It is. But the lawsuits of deep-pocketed fossil fuel corporations against any and everyone who dares to challenge their profiteering destruction are really also about our ability as non-billionaires to use our voice to speak out about anything. But not speaking out is increasingly a non-option. So where are we? We'll learn about a case that is weaponizing the legal system against everybody who wants a livable future from Kirk Herbertson, U.S. Director for Advocacy and Campaigns at Earth Rights International. That's coming up, but first, a look back at some recent press. New Federal Communications Commission Chair Brendan Carr has got right to work on what you might not think of, but he certainly understands as his job. He's revived right-wing requests to sanction TV stations over their presidential election coverage, alleging his power as regulator to determine not just the rules, but the outcome of news media operations. The complaints, previously dismissed by the FCC as incompatible with the First Amendment's guarantee of a free press, were summarized at Deadline as including one against ABC's Philadelphia affiliate, WPVI-TV, alleging bias in ABC's hosting of the September presidential debate, one against WCBS-TV in New York that accuses CBS of news distortion in the way that 60 Minutes edited an interview with Kamala Harris, and another against WNBC-TV in New York for alleged violations of the equal time rule when Saturday Night Live featured Harris in a cameo the weekend before the presidential election. As Ars Technica reported, Carr has, quote, embraced Trump's view that broadcasters should be punished for supposed anti-conservative bias, close quote. One target of this suit, ABC, has already settled another bogus Trump lawsuit for $15 million, which should be proof that even feeding MAGA massive amounts of money won't protect media outlets from their wrath. As Seth Stern, director of advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation, told FAIR, quote, rather than guessing precisely what line of attack might come next, broadcasters will be incentivized to tone down their coverage overall and make it more friendly to the Trump administration, close quote. Worse, he added, viewers won't know that that self-censorship is happening. We only know what gets aired, he said. We don't know what gets pulled. Stern said the press can continue to take legal action to defend the First Amendment under Trump, but that journalists should also advocate for free speech through their outlets. Journalists are always hesitant to write about press freedom for fear of making themselves the story, Stern said, but the time for that is long gone. You're not making yourself the story. Trump is. Brendan Carr's It's Only Regulation If I Don't Like It worldview is wind to the sails of the likes of Jeff Bezos, who has declared that one of the charms on his bracelet, the Washington Post, no longer seeks to use the protected power of the press to speak truth to power. Bezos delivered a note no real journalist would dream of writing, declaring that free markets and personal liberties, whatever those words mean, are underserved in the current market of ideas and news information. So the Washington Post is going to step boldly into that void. Even Post editorial page editor David Shipley, who signed off on the paper's refusal to endorse Kamala Harris, saw himself out over that ham-fisted anti-journalism directive. But presumably Bezos believes lots of subscribers will stay, and those that won't don't matter, and somehow new ones may be attracted to an outlet that promises to promote free markets, directed by a guy who loves himself a government subsidy. Because, P.S., according to Good Jobs First's Amazon tracker, Bezos's bootstrap rise and grind operation has been promised over $11.6 billion from the big bad government, including their biggest subsidy to date, over $4.3 billion to build a data center in Indiana. You could write an article about how it's weird that a free market operation would need billions from the state to build what is presumably a community-serving better mousetrap. That might be a helpful piece about how the government actually works and how it doesn't work. But there's at least one newspaper that would never run it. Finally, as the New York Times and others report, cutting Medicaid, part of the budget plan that House Republicans are gunning for, would cause millions of people to lose their health coverage unless states step up. The Washington Post noted that even some Republican Congress members, like New Jersey's Jeff Van Drew, called the move a mistake that Republicans might lose the majority over. Van Drew then voted to go forward with what Trump called a big, beautiful bill. While many people are genuinely worried that they can no longer afford the medicine and treatments that keep them alive, the Washington Post was interested in how, quote, the possibility of Medicaid cuts has become a headache for the most vulnerable Republicans in Congress, close quote. Because, you know, some of them, quote, seek to position themselves as the party of the working class, close quote. Readers learned that Van Drew, for his part, voted for the budget resolution because, quote, Trump appears 100% committed to keeping Medicaid other than waste, fraud, and abuse, close quote. He also assured the paper and they us that he expects the GOP's plan that he endorsed to change once the Senate gets involved. But many people won't even understand this story as relating to them, not just because outlets like The Post choose to talk about how significant cuts to social safety net programs could hurt swing district House Republicans, particularly those who represent lower income communities, rather than talking about how the cuts would hurt lower income communities and whether or not those communities have adequate representation. But it's also because Medicaid isn't called Medicaid in everybody's state. Clarifying that would be a job for journalists. And if they aren't doing it, well, people should look up whether the proposed cuts will affect, in Alaska, Denali Care. In Colorado, Health First Colorado. In Connecticut, Husky Health. In Delaware, Diamond State Health Plan. In Hawaii, MedQuest. In Tennessee, it's TennCare. You get the idea. And while you are figuring out whether or not you can still see a doctor, you might call or write to your local media to ask them whether or not they are interested in whether you can see a doctor. And if not, well, why not? You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Energy Transfer is the fossil fuel corporation that built the Dakota Access Pipeline to carry fracked oil from the Bakken fields more than 1,000 miles into Illinois, cutting through unceded indigenous land and crossing and recrossing the Missouri River that is a life source for the Standing Rock Tribe and others in the region. Counterspin listeners know that protests launched by the indigenous community drew international attention and participation, as well as the deployment by Energy Transfer's private security forces of unleashed attack dogs and pepper spray, among other things, against peaceful protesters. Now Energy Transfer says it was harmed and someone must pay, and that someone is Greenpeace, who the company is suing for $300 million, more than 10 times their annual budget. No one would have showed up to Standing Rock, is the company's story, and they're sticking to it, without the misinformed incitement of the veteran environmental group. Legalese aside, what's actually happening here, and what would appropriate reporting look like? We're joined by Kirk Herbertson, U.S. Director for Advocacy and Campaigns at Earth Rights International. He joins us now by phone from the D.C. area. Welcome to Counterspin, Kirk Herbertson.
Thanks so much, Janine.
Well, let me ask you first to take a minute to talk about what SLAPP lawsuits are, and then why this case fits the criteria.
Sure. So this case is one of the most extraordinary examples of abuse of the U.S. legal system that we have encountered in at least the last decade. And anyone who is concerned about protecting free speech rights or is concerned about large corporations abusing their power to silence their critics should be paying attention to this case, even though it's happening in North Dakota State Court. So as you mentioned, there's a kind of wonky term for this type of tactic that the company Energy Transfer is using. It's called a SLAPP lawsuit. It stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. But what it really means is it's a tactic in which wealthy and powerful individuals or corporations try to silence their critics' constitutional rights to free speech or freedom of assembly by dragging them through expensive, stressful, and very lengthy litigation. So in many SLAPP lawsuits, the intention is to try to silence your critic by intimidating them so much, by having them be sued by a multi-million, multi-billion dollar corporation, that they give up their advocacy and stop criticizing the corporation.
Well, it's a lot about using the legal system for purposes that most of us just don't think is the purpose of the legal system. It's kind of like the joke is on us. And in this case, there just isn't evidence to make their case. I mean, let's talk about their specific case. Greenpeace incited Standing Rock. If you're going to look at it in terms of evidence in a legal case, there's just no there.
That's right. This case, it was first filed in federal court. Right now it's in state court. But if you read the original complaint that was put together by Energy Transfer, they referred to Greenpeace as rogue eco-terrorists, essentially. They were really struggling to try to find some reason for bringing this lawsuit. It seemed like the goal was more to silence this organization and send a message. And in fact, the executive of the company said as much in media interviews. But yeah, so normally what happens in a civil lawsuit, so civil litigation plays a very important role in the U.S. system. So it's a way where if someone is harmed by someone else, then they can go to court and then they can seek compensation for the damages from that person or company or organization for the portion of the damages that they contributed to. So it's a very fair and mostly effective way of making sure that people are not harmed and that their rights are respected by others. But because the litigation process is so expensive and takes so many years, it's really open to abuse, and that's what we're seeing here.
Right. So it's just power over, and folks won't think of Greenpeace as being a less powerful organization. But if you're going to bring millions and millions of dollars to bear and all the time in the world and all of your legal team, you can break a group down. And that seems to be the point of this.
Absolutely. And one of the big signs here is the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline were not led by Greenpeace. And Greenpeace did not play any sort of prominent role in the protests.
Right.
So these were protests that were led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, who was directly affected by the pipeline traveling through its primary water source and also traveling through a lane where they alleged that it was violating their treaty rights as an indigenous nation. So they started to protest and take action to ask for this pipeline not to be approved. And then it inspired many other indigenous tribes around the country, many activists, and soon it grew into a movement of thousands of people with hundreds of organizations supporting it, both in the U.S. and internationally. Greenpeace was one of hundreds. So even in the case where Energy Transfer damages and wants to seek compensation for it, it's really a telltale sign of this abusive tactic that they are going after Greenpeace.
Right.
They have chosen to go after a high-profile, renowned environmental organization and played a very secondary role in this whole protest.
So it's clear that it's symbolic, and yet we don't think of our legal system as being used in that way. But the fact that this is not really about the particulars of the case, an actual harm being done to Energy Transfer by Greenpeace, that's also made clear when you kind of look at the process. For example, I mean, and there's a lot, the judge allowed Energy Transfer to seal evidence on their pipeline safety history. I mean, there are problems in the process of the way this case has unfolded that also should raise some questions.
That's right. So when the case was first filed, I won't go through the full timeline of the protests and everything that happened. It's very in-depth and it's well covered online. But the pipeline became operational in June 2017, and a little over 1 month later, that's when the first lawsuit was filed against Greenpeace and others. And that first lawsuit was filed in federal court. And so Energy Transfer brought it into federal court, and they tried to claim at that point that Greenpeace was essentially involved in mafia-like racketeering. They used the RICO statute, which was created to fight against the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they first alleged harm and tried to bring this lawsuit. The federal court did not accept that argument, and in fact, they wrote in their decision when they eventually dismissed it that they gave Energy Transfer several opportunities to actually allege that Greenpeace had harmed them in some way.
Right.
And they couldn't. So it was dismissed in federal court, and then 1 month later, they refiled in North Dakota State Court, where there are not these protections in place, and they filed in a local area very strategically. They picked an area close to where there was a lot of information flowing around the protests at the time. So it was argued a situation where there had already been a lot of negative media coverage bombarding the local population about what had happened. So going forward, 6 years later, we've now started a jury trial just in the last week of February. We'll see what happens. It's going to be very difficult for this trial to proceed in a purely objective way.
Well, and we're going to add links to deep, informative articles when we put this show up, because there is history here. But I want to ask you just to speak to the import of it. You know, folks may not have seen anything about this story. First of all, Standing Rock sounds like it happened in the past. It's not in the past. It's in the present. But this is so important. Yesterday, I got word that groups including Jewish Voice for Peace, National Students for Justice in Palestine, they're filing to dismiss a slap suit against them for a peaceful demonstration at O'Hare Airport. This is meaningful and important. I want to ask you to say, what should we be thinking about right now?
There's a lot of potential implications of this case, even though it's happening out in North Dakota State Court, where you wouldn't think it would have nationwide implications.
Right.
One is, as you mentioned, this has become an emblematic example of a slap lawsuit. But this is not the first slap lawsuit. There's, for years, slaps have been used by the wealthy and powerful to silence their critics. And I can name some very high-profile political actors and others who have used this tactic quite a bit. Slaps are First Amendment issue, and there has been bipartisan concern with the use of slaps to begin with. So there are a number of other states, when there have been anti-SLAPP laws that are passed, they have passed on an overwhelmingly bipartisan basis. So just to say, this is a free speech issue that in normal times would be a no-brainer. This should be something that there should be bipartisan support around protecting free speech, because it's not just about environmental organizations here. I think one of the big implications of this trial going forward at this time in this current environment is that if Energy Transfer prevails, this could really embolden other corporations and powerful actors to bring copycat lawsuits, as well as use other related tactics to try to weaponize the law in order to punish free speech that they do not agree with. So, and we've seen this happen with other aspects of the fossil fuel industry. If something is successful in one place, it gets picked up and used again and again all over the country.
Well, yes, this is a thing. And you, I know, have a particular focus on protecting activists who are threatened based on their human rights advocacy, and also trying to shore up access to justice for people who are, and I want to underscore this, who are victims of human rights abuses perpetrated by economic actors such as corporations and financial institutions. So I'm thinking about Berta Cáceres. I'm thinking about Tortuguita. I don't love corporate media's crime template. It's kind of simplistic and one side, two sides, and it's kind of about revenge. And yet I still note that the media can't tell certain stories when they're about corporate crimes as crimes. Somehow the framework doesn't apply when it comes to a big, nameless, faceless corporation that might be killing hundreds of people. And I feel like that framing from media harms public understanding and societal response. And I just wonder what you think about media's role in all of this.
Yes, I think that's right. And I could give you a whole dissertation answer on this. But for my work, I work both internationally and in the U.S. to support people who are speaking up about environmental issues.
Right.
So this is a trend globally. If you're a community member or an environmental activist who speaks up about environmental issues, that's actually one of the most dangerous activities you can do in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, hundreds of people are killed and assassinated for speaking up about environmental issues, and many of them are indigenous people, like it happened here. In the United States, we fortunately don't see as many direct assassinations of people who are speaking up, but what we do see is the phenomenon that we call criminalization, which includes slap lawsuits. And that really exploits gray areas in the legal system that allow the wealthy and powerful to weaponize the legal system and turn it into a vehicle for silencing their critics. Often it's not, as you say, it's not written into the law that this is illegal. In a lot of cases, there are more and more anti-SLAPP laws in place, but not in North Dakota. And so that really makes it challenging to explain what's happening. And I think, as you say, that also is a challenge for journalists and media organizations that are reporting on these types of attacks.
Well, let me bring you back to the legal picture, because I know, as a lot of us know, that what we're seeing right now is not new. It's brazen, but it's not new. It's working from a template or like a vision board
right.
that folks have had for a while. And I know that a couple of years back, you were working with Jamie Raskin, among others, on a legislative response to this tactic. Is that still a place to look? What do you think?
Yes. So there's several efforts underway because there's different types of tactics that are being used at different levels.
Right.
But there is an effort in Congress, and it's being led by Congressman Jamie Raskin, most recently Congressman Kevin Kiley, who's a Republican from California, and Senator Ron Wyden. So they have most recently introduced bipartisan bills in the House, just Senator Wyden for now in the Senate. But that's to add protections at the federal level to try to stop the use of SLAPP lawsuits. And that effort is continuing and will hopefully continue to have bipartisan support.
Well, let's maybe close with Deepa Padmanabha, who's Greenpeace's legal advisor. She said that this lawsuit, Energy Transfer versus Greenpeace, is trying to divide people. It's not about the law. It's about public information and public understanding. And she said, quote, Energy Transfer and the fossil fuel industry do not understand the difference between entities and movements. You can't bankrupt the movement. You can't silence the movement, close quote. I find that powerful. We're in a very scary time. Folks are looking to the law to save us in a place where the law can't necessarily do that. But what are your thoughts, finally, about the importance of this case and what you would hope journalism would do about it?
Well, I think this case is important for Greenpeace, obviously, but as Deepa said, this is important for environmental justice movements and social justice movements more broadly. And I agree with what she said very strongly. I think both Greenpeace and Earth Rights, where I work, are part of a nationwide coalition called Protect the Protest, that was created to help respond to these types of threats that are emerging all over the country. And our mantra is, if you come after one of us, you come after all of us. I think no matter the outcome of this trial, one of the results will be that there will be a movement that is responding to what happened, continuing to work to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable, and also to put a spotlight on Energy Transfer and its record and how it's relating and engaging with the communities where it tries to operate.
We've been speaking with Kirk Herbertson. He's U.S. Director for Advocacy and Campaigns at Earth Rights International. They're online at earthrights.org. Thank you so much, Kirk Herbertson, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find decades of shows on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to learn about our newsletter, Extra, and it's also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show's engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Trump has declared that the U.S. is going to take over the Gaza Strip, that the Palestinians who live there will be permanently exiled. Again, asked whether Palestinians would have the right to return to Gaza under his scheme, Trump said no. But even those corporate news media who aren't actually endorsing this illegal, inhumane plan still can't seem to find it in themselves to call it what it is, ethnic cleansing. Media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak has been looking into big media's systematic refusal to use appropriate language about the human rights crimes unfolding before our eyes in Palestine. He teaches English and media studies at the University of Guelph-Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the book The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. Also on the show, there is a deep, if muddled, sense that the U.S. tax system is unfair. The little guy pays too much, and rich folks find loopholes and offshore accounts. But then, on a different page, there's a story about how we, as a country, don't have enough resources to allow school kids to eat lunch, because that would mean the dreaded higher taxes. But we will shell out another billion for a fighter.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
While the money may not be important to Energy Transfer, a $300 million judgment would shut down Greenpeace USA. Our decades-long storied legacy of fighting for people and the planet could come to an end.
A closely watched trial is taking place in North Dakota that could bankrupt Greenpeace and show protest movements across the country. The Texas pipeline company Energy Transfer sued Greenpeace for $300 million over its role supporting the indigenous-led protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. We'll speak to Greenpeace and Indigenous water protector Winona LaDuke. Then, we look at the Oscar-nominated film, Sugarcane. It's an investigation into devastating abuse at an Indian residential school in Canada.
For decades, there were reports of neglect and children dying or disappearing from this facility.
Two girls drowned. Priests were moved around.
Why are they dying?
Did they think we'd be stupid? All of our lives, the rest of our lives, and nobody would ever find out these things.
We'll speak to Sugarcane co-directors Emily Cassie and Julian Brave Noisecat. His father is the only known survivor of the practice of infanticide at the St. Joseph's Mission School in Canada. Plus, we remember Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old active duty Air Force member who self-immolated a year ago outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. to protest U.S. support for Israel. We'll speak to one of his closest friends, as well as an Air Force member who was inspired by Aaron to seek conscientious objector status. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump has ordered the U.S. to suspend all military aid to Ukraine. The stunning reversal came just days after Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office in a shocking confrontation that was broadcast live around the world. On Monday, Trump suggested Zelensky, quote, won't be around very long if he refuses to make a deal with Russia.
President Zelensky supposedly made a statement today in AP. I'm not a big fan of AP, so maybe it was an incorrect statement, but he said he thinks the war's going to go on for a long time. And he better not be right about that. That's all I'm saying.
Trump's shut off of arms shipments prompted shock, anger, and condemnation across Ukraine and much of Europe. Germany's likely next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, called attacks on Zelensky a manufactured escalation. French Prime Minister François Bayrou said Zelensky's treatment was, quote, marked by brutality, a desire to humiliate. And the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk called on European nations to massively increase military spending. Stock prices of European weapons manufacturers soared Monday. Ukrainian officials have pledged to do all they can to keep the U.S. as an ally and reiterated they remain open to a deal on rare earth minerals. Meanwhile, the Kremlin welcomed Trump's suspension of arms to Ukraine, saying it would push Kyiv to the negotiating table. Global stock markets plunged as Trump's 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and 10% tariffs on China took effect today. At midnight, Canada announced it was imposing 25% tariffs on $30 billion worth of U.S. goods with an expansion of tariffs planned in 3 weeks. China imposed 15% tariffs on U.S. imports of chicken, wheat, corn, and cotton, and 10% on other U.S. goods, including soybeans, meat, produce, dairy products. Beijing urged the U.S. to abandon its bullying stance and engage in talks. Instead,
the United States should engage in consultations with China on the basis of equality, mutual respect, and